Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulaby. Just a reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, a centuries-old violin is selling for $18 million, not exactly within the price range of most actual violinists. A filmmaker wonders why it's so hard getting Hollywood to tell black stories. And a 50 Great Voices profile of a Hawaiian musician who redefined a great American song. But first,
I Love You, Philip Morris opens with a promise written on the screen. This really happened. It really did. There is a Philip Morris. There is a Stephen Russell who loves him. A man who actually did walk out of Texas jails and prisons four times without a weapon or a hostage. And all for love. It was the love story that attracted Glenn Ficarra and John Requa, screenwriting partners who gave the world Bad Santa, to write and direct a film about Russell. They pitched the story to a studio affiliated with the publisher of the nonfiction book about this con man.
And that didn't go so well.
Their only comment was, could Philip be a girl?
Requa says he and Ficarra wanted to make a classic romantic comedy, but with two gay men in the Rock Hudson and Doris Day roles.
To say that the gay subject matter and just the frankness of the film played no part in our distribution problems would be a lie. I mean, it did. We went with a distributor who was not one of the major independent distributors at Sundance because I believe that the larger distributors were afraid of it because it wasn't a gay message movie and it was a frank depiction of gay life.
Despite the fact that they landed a major star in Jim Carrey and a distributor, the film languished in financial limbo for more than a year, its American release scheduled and rescheduled while Europe got a good look at it. Even Stephen Russell's seen a little of it on a reporter's iPad. Requa and Ficarra went to see Russell as they were working on the film.
When you go to prison and visit him, it's like seeing Hannibal Lecter.
Well, he's not wheeled in on a hand truck or chained to the wall, and there's no leather mask. But he is brought shackled into a tiny cubicle behind a thick plexiglass window. The door behind him shuts, and he leans backward to put his hands through the slot in the door, where the guard in the hall takes off his cuffs. We sit on steel stools bolted to the floor and talk on a telephone. They hand him a microphone through the slot in the door.
Everything comes to me through something just like that slot right there. My mail, my food, my books. Everything. And you don't reach out and touch.
Anyone, because he poses such an escape risk. He lives alone in a cell, locked down 23 hours a day.
All by myself, not touching another individual, not being able to hold my daughter, hug her, not being able to hug Philip, and it's my fault.
Because he embarrassed the entire Texas prison system by impersonating judges, lawyers, and doctors, and literally walking out the doors of prisons four times. Today, Russell's locked in the maximum security Michael unit south of Dallas. It's been 14 years since his last escape. He does still hear from Philip Morris.
When I hear from him, it's through letters. Now, he's on my visitation list. So far, he hasn't come to see me, but it's more of a mutual thing because I can imagine how constipated the guards would be if he came up here. Now, again, he's on the list, and if he's listening to the broadcast, I think he should come and visit. How's that for a pitch?
Russell's excited about the movie, what he's seen of it. He particularly thinks Jim Carrey gets that daydreaming thing, where the actor sits and starts to think, as Russell says he often does, determined to think about something other than his 144-year sentence for theft and, of course, escape.
You sit there and you start thinking about, why is that door open right now? Is that door always going to be open? Or is that front door going to always be open? What is she going to do? Is she going to be talking on the telephone? Or is she going to be paying attention to who's going through the front door?
Not that he's planning to escape again.
No, not now. I wouldn't wait 14 years to burn off. If I was going to burn off or escape from prison, I would have already done it.
Really? Somewhere tonight, in the Michael unit, Stephen Russell is listening to me talk. He does get to listen to radio. But they move him to a new cell every week, he told me. The way he sees it, they really want their escape artist to get to know the whole building. For NPR News, this is Pat Dowell.
The asking price is $18 million. That would make this violin the most expensive musical instrument ever sold. It was built in 1741. The sale probably won't go to a musician, though, and that worries some people in the concert world. Here's Vivian Goodman of member station WKSU.
The 269-year-old Vuitton Guarneri del Gesù is one of the oldest instruments ever to go on sale.
When I heard this, it was overwhelming, actually.
Chicago rare violin dealer Jeff Fucci is the one selling what he calls the Mona Lisa of violins on behalf of a London banker.
I've heard all the greatest violins. I said, am I hallucinating? That's the greatest violin sound I've ever heard.
But $18 million? Emmanuel Gradumont also deals in rare violins.
In many ways, it deserves this price. Personally, I feel that this price is really high.
It's also almost twice as high as the world record set in January when a billionaire Russian collector bought a Guarneri for $10.25 million. But Jeff Fucci is confident of getting his price. Fewer than 1,000 Strads and Guarneris survive today. They're a safe investment. Unlike gold, they're functional. And Fucci likes to point out that over five decades, while the Dow rose 1,400%, rare violins appreciated 26,000%. That's good for investors.
It's kind of tough on the musician.
Joel Smirnoff, president of the Cleveland Institute of Music.
No one who will enter the concert world today will have the resource to actually purchase a great instrument anymore.
Dealer Jeff Fucci feels no guilt, though, for pricing the Vuitton too high for a musician to own. Great players, he says, will still get it under their chins.
The past with these instruments has been that there have always been very wealthy people to acquire these instruments and then let brilliant artists use them.
Giora Schmidt's 1753 Giovanni Battista Guadagnini is a loner.
To own one is nearly impossible, even in making a very successful career as a traveling concert artist.
Schmidt worries every time the phone rings that the owner is calling to get his violin back. He's in the market now for a new one.
Unless an angel flies down from the sky, the instrument that I own will be something that is built by what we call a contemporary living maker.
Like Yanbing Chen.
This has a knot, so it might not be usable.
Chen is in his Cleveland workshop, watching one of his luthiers plane a plank of flame maple. Chen makes a few violins, but most of those he sells are made in Shanghai, where his family has another workshop.
This is by Yonghai Xu, my friend, a Chinese violin maker. I've been working with him for many years. I just make some sound.
Chen wants $4,000 for the Yonghai Xu. A more typical price tag for violins he imports from China is about $500.
You know, for the price, it's hard to compete. That's why I would say 80% of the student market are Chinese instruments.
Chinese factories turn out thousands of violins a year. Emmanuel Gradumont's Manhattan workshop produces about five.
I take one of these instruments that is brought over here by one of their salespeople and bring it to the workshop, and everybody in the workshop gets really depressed. It's excellent work, and the cost doesn't even cover us buying the wood here.
Joel Smirnoff, formerly of the Juilliard String Quartet, plays a $3,000 Chinese violin.
So that's what I like about this fiddle. It really does nuance beautifully. Maybe it's just because I'm aging, but I find it a very comfortable fiddle to play. But of course, then there's my wife who says, Joel, you should play a great fiddle, because she thinks I'm silly.
But some would say it's just as silly for 300-year-old Guarneris and Strads to hang in collectors' display cases. Giora Schmidt.
These instruments are meant to be played. If it's been sitting there in somebody's closet for 50 years, the wood hasn't vibrated. The wood needs to vibrate.
Joel Smirnoff agrees violins benefit from an acoustic massage.
But on the other hand, if an instrument hasn't been played for a long time, let's say an instrument hasn't been played for 40 or 50 years, it can be revived. You know, it's kind of like Sleeping Beauty. You kiss the thing and, hey, it will come back to life. There's a lovely quality about an instrument which has been sitting It's dancing with the wallflower, so to speak.
The $18 million Vuitton hasn't been a complete wallflower. Joshua Bell played a week of concerts with it this year. But the world's most expensive musical instrument mostly sits in a case in a Chicago showroom. The highest bidder so far, at $16 million, is a prominent collector. For NPR News, I'm Vivian Goodman in Cleveland.
The number of African Americans in the movie business is shockingly low. Here's one statistic. More than 500 movies came out last year. 9 of them had black directors. Or try this number. Last summer, there were only 2 Hollywood movies with a black male star at the top of the marquee. They were The Karate Kid, played by 12-year-old Jaden Smith, and Lottery Ticket, starring former Kid rapper Bow Wow. These statistics weren't news to Donnell Alexander, but this year he tried breaking into the business anyway.
I've co-produced a true story short movie about a pitcher who threw a no-hitter while tripping on acid. The thing's gone viral and is something very cool, according to both the internet and the film festival circuit. I want to make it into a movie that as many people as possible can see, so I've begun peddling it around Hollywood. Feedback is boiled down to, kid, don't bet on it. The Hitch, I'm told, is my protagonist. He's a black guy, and not your standard issue big movie black guy. A project like mine is a long shot, and that says something about the movie industry. But what? I don't have enough miles on my odometer to know, so I thought I'd ask other, more veteran filmmakers.
These conversations always come back to, you know, the booty call Rosewood conversation.
Indie director Barry Jenkins has a theory, one I'd heard before, which goes back to 97. Picture John Singleton still riding high off Boys in the Hood, deciding to do his prestige picture. A movie capable of showing that black films could do big business.
Hollywood put up the money, and John Singleton made Rosewood, which is a pretty good film, you know?
In 1923, the black town of Rosewood was a land of opportunity.
And the movie came out, you know, it's big budget, black Hollywood epic.
Tell me the truth. Was it truly our color, Don Destiny?
And absolutely tanked. You know, no one went out and supported that film. And the very next weekend, Booty Call came out.
Dog, if you don't get... What is this? Hey.
Leave Killer alone. He does live here, and you are just visiting Buns.
Well, if we was really in China, I'd have his ass honey roasted.
A fraction of the budget. And absolutely, I mean, not to bash anyone who made Booty Call, but nowhere near as meritorious as Rosewood as a cultural endeavor.
Thing is, Booty Call totally makes me laugh. And not just because of the name. Jamie Foxx turns into a movie star right before your eyes.
Made tons of money. Made more money than Rosewood. And I think when you look at those two weekends back to back, and that was over a decade ago, I think it really is one of the first steps in what's gotten us to this point that you and I are having this conversation right now.
What lesson did the film industry take away from those consecutive weekends? That the blacks we put on screen will have to be broadly funny or flatly evil if we plan to recoup our investment. Aside from the occasional drama backed by a superstar like Oprah Winfrey, the thoughtful Hollywood film about and by black people went out with mobile pagers. Writer-director Michael Elliott has been making a living in Hollywood and says studio executives believe they can't sell tickets when they take a black movie overseas.
There's a whole huge stream of revenue that studios feel like they don't get to taste because the project's black. There is no foreign market for this, and we've been told this. Forever.
Elliott's made his way in the industry by producing modestly budgeted romantic comedies with black people in front of and usually behind the cameras. His latest, Just Right, did okay in theaters and as a DVD.
When am I going to meet that one amazing guy who thinks I'm the one woman he can't live without?
The success of Just Right was based on having Queen Latifah, a bankable star, which is to say, capable of bringing in an audience on opening weekend. The list Hollywood keeps of bankable black female leads has 2 names.
The list is like, it's really, 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 really small. There's moments where Halle Berry is on that list and Queen Latifah is on that list. And that's where it stops. On the male side, there's actors who are really not on the list because they have such a mainstream and foreign appeal, a la Will Smith, Denzel Washington. Those men aren't really considered black actors.
Hold the phone. Denzel and Will aren't black? You lost me.
Meaning that they have such crossover appeal to white people that white people don't really view them as like black. They view Will Smith as Will Smith. They don't really see him. They don't see color.
Whatever. My man with the booty call theory knew he couldn't get Will Smith for his movie. It's a low-budget sleeper called Medicine for Melancholy. In it, two strangers bike and dance around San Francisco in the wake of drunken stranger party sex.
It seems like the city just pisses you off.
Nah, I love this city. I hate this city, but I love this city. San Francisco's beautiful. You shouldn't have to be upper middle class to be a part of that.
Medicine for Melancholy screened in just three American cities, one at a time, and then Barry Jenkins took it on to the international festival circuit.
And I went to Krakow, Poland, Toronto, Buenos Aires, Mar del Plata, to Paris, London, and the reaction was always absolutely amazing. Literally, I had people say to me in many different languages, "We've never seen black people like this before." And I was like, well, they exist in pretty much every city.
I want to do what Barry Jenkins did, make a picture about compelling people in situations that captivate. Characters, our complicated racial past is kept at bay. But I want to make money. The closest the industry has come to this in recent history is with Precious. That one made money, both at home and abroad. The project also happened to have the Tyler Perry and Oprah brands behind it. Even so, Precious wasn't made by Hollywood. It came up through the festival circuit.
It was an example of a film that began at Sundance and then went to Toronto and then in the marketplace tracked. When these movies are allowed to actually perform and they're supported properly, I think a lot of these urban legends or these Hollywood legends that we like to talk about, they're disproven.
It's important not to take the urban legends too personally. In the film history, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, Peter Biskin wrote, "Because movies are expensive and time-consuming to make, Hollywood is always the last to know, the slowest to respond. In times of economic austerity, it's not the obvious move to make more big black films. But who knows? Maybe some other filmmaker will create a hit with a black point of view and characters born of it, and it'll do boffo box office all over, and I'll get a meaningful studio meeting. But I'm fully prepared to book a flight to Krakow. Word is that the Poles dig films about complicated black Americans."
Donnell Alexander is the author of the book Ghetto Celebrity, Searching for My Father in Me.
Today we begin a series of stories about hitmakers, people who create songs that top the charts. Their music spills out of car windows, leaks out of earbuds, and gets compressed into ringtones. It's music that shapes the way young fans see themselves and how they relate to each other.
For this series, we're going to studios and clubs in the music capitals of the country, New York, Nashville, Atlanta, and today, Los Angeles. The hitmaker we'll meet now is very aware of her own cultural influence. And as NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, she's a music industry rarity, a top female producer.
Bass.
She is the only female producer at Jay-Z's label, Roc Nation.
Hi.
She's behind this number one hit by Beyoncé.
Ready? Let's go get 'em. Come on.
Makeba Riddick has written and produced hits for Mariah Carey, Toni Braxton, and the rapper T.I.
It takes a lot to get somebody to believe that me, this girl from Baltimore City, graduated from Berklee College of Music, she can actually write a hit record that the whole world is gonna fall in love with.
Riddick got this, her first number one hit on the radio when she was 21 years old, taking two trains and a bus every day to work as an intern for Sony Music. Now, she says vocal production is the most important part of what she does in songs like this.
Just gonna stand there and watch me burn. Well, that's all right because I like the way it hurts.
One of last summer's biggest hits. Riddick is known in the business as Rihanna's producer. Their other monster hit this year was nearly a non-starter, until someone from the label called Makeba Riddick.
He was like, you know, we think this could be a hit, but it's not finished. The hook needs to be reworked. We need a second verse. We need a bridge. We need some arrangements. Gave it to me and said, give us some magic.
Right now, Makeba Riddick, in a velvet curtain studio, is leaning against the soundboard in a pair of shapely blue high heels. She commands attention without trying, like a favorite teacher.
I'm back in the studio with Dark Child, and we're about to come up with another hit.
Dark Child is Rodney Jerkins, a legend. He's produced massive hits for Michael Jackson, Britney Spears, Destiny's Child.
Dark Child, nah, nah.
Say my name, say my name.
And he produced Lady Gaga's Telephone. Jerkins has been producing so long, he's got gold-plated cassettes on his studio walls. But he says making hits depends on understanding how kids see themselves, right down to how they talk.
How can I make the kids say this that they've never said before? That's very, very important. My job is, how can I create something new that no one's ever heard before?
We, as culture makers, have a responsibility.
They both know that their songs shape the way kids talk, dress, interact. For their message to go global, they have to shape the messengers.
We are a star to the stars. We help them to craft that persona and that sound that the world is gonna fall in love with.
That means channeling the specific psyches of pop music's biggest consumers, teenaged girls.
I think I've heard myself say on more than one occasion, is a 13-year-old girl in Iowa's mother going to be comfortable with her daughter saying this or listening to this?
That is the marketplace.
LaShawn Daniels is working with Riddick today. He's another star R&B producer. Like Riddick, he follows cartoons and kids' TV to stay current. I am invited to sit in as Daniels and Riddick write a song, but they're just hanging out in the studio, eating grapes and tweeting. Rodney Jerkins wanders in to ask if they've heard of a new boy band called Mindless Behavior.
What do they call it? Minus?
Mindless Behavior?
Uh-uh.
Four little boys between the ages of 12 and 13.
So like some little Justin Biebers.
They check them out on YouTube.
How old are they? Three?
Rodney Jerkins says he needs a song for the band. He lays down a track and walks out. Makeba Riddick goes back to tweeting. LaShawn Daniels looks at celebrity gossip sites and laughs at pictures of famous singers in their bathing suits. They're humming, talking about other boy bands, ordering out for sushi. Just when I wonder when they'll start working, it hits me. They already are.
Why that feels like such a hook to me.
Next comes figuring out this song's concept and title.
Maybe it could be like friend requests.
They throw around Facebook ideas.
You know, I'm sending
then
you a
Makeba Riddick loses patience.
Forget about Facebook. I'm at the bar. You are at the other side of the bar. Right. I'm going to send you a bottle of champagne as a friend request.
Right, but how are we translating it to these kids?
Riddick and Daniels are so conscious they are selling music to 13-year-olds who want to imagine themselves as older. So they want to cater to that, but need to be careful about what's appropriate for preteen singers. Daniels suggests the title First Kiss.
Does that make it too young?
Stealing kisses.
Stealing kisses.
Is that too risque? Is it too racy?
I don't think it's too racy or too risque. Is it corny? That's
Stealing
the question.
Kisses, we got to make it fly.
LaShawn Daniels and Makeba Riddick finished the song in less than 3 hours.
What's your name? Have you met somewhere before, or are you the same girl I've been seeing in my dreams? It's a shame.
The boy band's label, Interscope, thought the song was fly enough to buy it. 13-year-old girls and their mothers in Iowa and everywhere else may be hearing the final version on the radio in a few months. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
The success of that song we just heard Makeba Riddick write will depend on whether all those teenage girls love what they hear. Girls like Monty Huntington, Aisha Jones, and Carla Otley at Luke Moore Academy in Washington, D.C.
You know it's a good song. You're going to listen to it again and again and again. Me, I put it on repeat and won't stop it until I get tired of it.
Or if I like put it on my Facebook status.
And when I want to get as a ringtone.
Mary J. Blige, Not Gonna Cry. That's my song. That song just takes me there. Like, I blast it right there in the living room. And I sit there and I sing every last word over and over and over and over and over and over.
I'm not gonna cry. I'm not gonna shed no tears.
It's like, okay, you like a boy. When he come around you, you feel like this love connection between the both of y'all. And when you see him talking to other females, you be like, why is he talking to her? You supposed to be talking to me. I'm in love with you. But Shona, I tell him.
Oh, Nana, what's my name? Oh, Nana, what's my name?
Rihanna new song, What's My Name, featuring Drake. I'm like, when she be like, what's my name? And then she be like, oh, no, nah, no, nah, that part. Yeah, because everybody want people to know their name.
That's my song.
That's my song.
That's my song. That's my favorite song. That's my favorite song in the world.
Monty Huntington, Aisha Jones, and Carla Ottley at Luke Moore Academy in Washington, D.C. Next week in our series, we'll visit a hit factory that claims to be the loudest studio in New York. As part of NPR's series 50 Great Voices, we bring you the story of a brilliant voice, a brilliant song, and how they came together.
Ooh, ooh, over the
this is Israel Kamaka Viva Ole, the late Hawaiian musician who did something rare in music. He redefined a beloved classic. His version of Over the Rainbow has the poignancy of Judy Garland's and the shimmering vulnerability. But these days, it's heard so often on TV and in the movies, a younger generation may know only Israel's version.
Somewhere over the rainbow, bluebirds fly, and the dream that she did to Hawaii.
It's not only the voice. In Hawaii, we talk about this thing, what we call mana.
Del Beasley is a musician and childhood friend of Israel's.
Mana is like an energy that you get. We believe we get ours from all of the elements first, yeah? Your earth, your sky, your ocean, your God. And all that is inside of us. And when we open our mouth to either speak, to sing, or to play, that's what we let out.
Del Beasley remembers the first time he heard Israel sing. They were teenagers, and Israel showed up with his older brother Skippy at a graduation party.
They set up with instruments that were kind of beat up. In fact, one of the ukuleles was held together with bubble gum. What happened was, as soon as Israel Kamaka Viva Ole opened his mouth and sang, that whole place went quiet. Every great singer has something special about him. And that thing just cut right through the air and, you know, just stopped everybody in their tracks.
Israel was still a teenager when he and his brother formed a band called the Makaha Sons of Ni'ihau. The 1970s was a time when young Hawaiians were rediscovering their language and culture. In music, that meant getting away from the kitschy hula tunes for tourists, like My Little Grass Shack. Israel's group was among those that embraced traditional melodies. Israel was the group's standout for his voice and also his size. Both he and his brother Skippy weighed hundreds of pounds, the girth of sumo wrestlers, and Israel was tall with flowing black hair. Then, in 1988, on his own, Israel Kamaka Viva Ole recorded a song that made him a legend. It began at 3 in the morning. Milan Bertosa was at the end of a long day in his Honolulu recording studio.
And the phone rings, and it was a client of mine. He said, I've got Israel Kamaka Laka 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 here. He said, well, he wants to come and record a demo. Well, shutting down, come back tomorrow. And he said, no, no, here, talk to Israel. So he puts Israel on the phone. And he's this really sweet man. He's well-mannered, just kind, and, you know, please can I come in? I got this idea.
At that, Bertosa relented and gave Israel 15 minutes to get there. Soon, there was a knock on the door.
And in walks, like, the largest human being I had seen in my life. Israel was probably about 500 pounds. I put up some microphones, do a quick sound check, roll tape, and the first thing he does is Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Meaning, he just took his ukulele and started singing.
He played and sang, and one take, and it was over. The next day, I got Israel a copy and filed the tape away.
It would be 5 years before that tape came off the shelf.
In 1993, Milan Bertosa was back in a studio with Israel making a solo album, and Bertosa had an epiphany. He fished out the recording of Over the Rainbow, and it ended up on Facing Future, still the best-selling Hawaiian album of all time, thanks to this one song.
You know, there's been a bunch of articles written about Somewhere Over the Rainbow. He gets the lyrics wrong. He changes the melody. You know, if you sat there with a book and a scorecard, you could count the mistakes, or you could just listen to the song and smile.
Well, trouble melts like lemon drops, high above the chimney top, that's where you find me, oh, somewhere over the rainbow.
Israel would only see the beginning of his song's amazing success. As he grew increasingly obese, he was in and out of the hospital. His brother Skippy had died from complications of obesity, as did all Israel's immediate family. Israel knew he was destined for a brief life, and for his producer, John DeMello, everything Israel sang and said became precious.
And if you're playing music with somebody that play, and you don't know the song, no play.
Every session, I would keep him for an hour afterwards and just tell me stories.
I was scared when I lost my mother, my father, my brother, my sister. I guess it's going to sound kind of weird. I'm not scared for myself for dying, because we Hawaiian. We live in both worlds. When our time comes, no cry for me, cuz. No cry for me.
In the summer of 1997, Israel Kamaka Viva Ole, by then one of the most beloved singers in the history of Hawaiian music, died of respiratory failure. He was 38. Israel's body lay in state at Hawaii's Capitol Building, a rare honor. Days later, he was cremated, and his ashes carried on a traditional Hawaiian voyaging canoe. His longtime friend Del Beasley and producer John DeMello were among those on board.
And going down the coastline, all the big semi-trucks on the island of Oahu had their air horns blowing. And from the ocean, we could hear the echo, the bounce off the mountain ranges.
In the old days, people would wail when the mo'i or the king passed away and cry. And that's really what it was. I mean, this whole island came together just to say goodbye to this one Hawaiian. He would have laughed, but I'll tell you that right now, he would have been laughing.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we had today and subscribe to NPR's Arts Channel at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.